today on Against the Grain. Is there such a thing as core gender identity? Are queer and trans people born that way? And what role does trauma play in shaping gender? I'm CS. The authors of Gender Without Identity offer answers to these and other questions coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Is gender a fixed and predetermined thing, or is it something else? If it's safer politically for queer and trans people to claim that they were born that way, so that there's nothing to convert them back to, should that be the end of the matter? What if trauma shapes to an extent all gender, including cisgender? Two thinkers, each a clinician and NYU-based scholar, have advanced a set of provocative arguments in a book called Gender Without Identity. Avhi Sakotopoulou is a psychoanalyst and a member of the faculty at New York University's postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. Anne Pellegrini is professor of performance studies and social and cultural analysis at NYU, and a practicing psychoanalyst. I asked them to lay out some of their arguments in the form of a prepared talk. You'll hear that today, followed by some Q&A. We begin the proceedings with Anne Pellegrini.
We wrote this book in order to intervene in current debates over transness, over queerness, that are happening within psychoanalysis, a field in which both of us are clinical practitioners, and in the wider culture. On the one hand, we're confronting something, the born this way argument, right? This is the argument that some people are born trans or born queer, just like others are born straight or born cis, where cis is a word now used to describe those who are normatively gendered, whose gender identity, gender experience aligns with the sex ascribed at birth. Now, no psychoanalyst explicitly endorses a born this way position. But it is the underlying presumption at work among gender-affirming clinicians, the idea that someone is ontologically, in some sense, trans or queer. On the other hand, as against the born-this-way position, we encounter what Avhi and I describe as a warped-this-way position. This is the idea that trans and queer individuals have deviated from the correct path, I'm putting correct in quotes here, the correct path of straightness, of cisness, and they've deviated because of trauma, because of the wrong kind of social influence. They wandered onto the wrong internet site, because of bad parenting, etc. Basically, something has gone wrong. The born this way argument has been offered politically and even clinically as a way of countering the violence of the warped this way position. Born this way as an argument intends to protect queer and trans life from pathologization, and from therapies that are aiming at fixing gendered and sexual deviations. And please hear the scare quotes around fixing and deviations. The onslaught of the anti-LGBTQ legislation sweeping the country and the powerful homotransphobic trends within psychotherapeutic fields, they can make it feel like, now more than ever, they can make it feel like the only viable position for clinicians who don't see queer and trans patients as pathological. They can make it feel like the only viable position for such clinicians is to double down on the born this way rhetoric, so that we must insist that trans and queer experience reflects some core and immutable part of the self, that it is somehow a true and authentic expression of one's innermost being. And this pressure to espouse a born this way position, this is especially true when it comes to trans kids, whose very existence is being challenged by today's anti-trans clinical activism. It's being challenged by the sweeping legislative and policy measures across the United States. In this activism, a commonly cited proof against trans kids is the idea that childhood transness is just a symptom of trauma. if children mistakenly think they are trans, the logic goes, it's because trauma has warped their connection with the true gender, as marked by their genitals and assigned at birth, a true gender which is always already cis and binary. What such young people need, some clinicians argue, is not transition care, but therapeutic attention that treats the trauma and which addresses the children's vulnerability to social contagion, and does so in order to correct their gender. Again, the word correct, scare quotes around it. Scare quotes also around social contagion, right? But these views, right, such views license lawmakers to pass bills that deny life possibilities to trans youth, and that do so in the name of protecting trans kids from themselves. And this is a much older argument, save the children, an argument that goes back to actually white supremacists who were seeking to prevent the desegregation of public schools in the naming of saving our children, where our children meant white children, or anti-gay activists who wanted to save our children from the contagion of any exposure to a gay adult. We heard this certainly during the heyday of Anita Bryant, and we're still hearing this now with Don't Say Gay bills in Florida and elsewhere, right? As of June 28th, and this information comes from a very important mapping project being done by the ACLU, as of June 28th, 527 anti-LGBTQ bills have been submitted to state legislatures across this country. This number, 527, beats last year's avalanche of anti-trans and anti-queer bills. Last year's number topped out at nationally at 510. So we're already ahead of last year's dismal number. This is not a record one wants to keep beating, right? 527, right? And this also is a very important thing to flag. The Supreme Court has just agreed to hear a challenge to a Tennessee law that bans gender affirmative care for trans youth. This will have implications far beyond the state of Tennessee. The court will hear this case in the fall, with a decision anticipated in late June of 2025. At that time, we could be 6 months into a new Trump administration. On the campaign trail, Trump is promising to use executive authority to undo the Biden administration's extension of Title IX protections to trans students. Trump has also pledged to ask Congress to pass federal legislation banning gender affirmative care for trans youth. Right now, bans on gender affirmative care for trans youth are taking place at the state level. If the Republicans were to win both houses of Congress, and if there is a Republican president, and in particular, this particular candidate were to become president again, Trump could well succeed in passing federal legislation to ban gender affirmative care for youth nationwide. Trump also says he'll stop federal agencies from taking actions that, in his words, quote, promote the concept of sex and gender transition at any age, close quote. And I really want to flag this language of at any age, because this is not just about, and has never only been about, trans youth. Hence laws banning the use of bathrooms that align with gender identity. Hence state laws that ban changing one's gender marker on the driver's license, as has happened in Florida, or changing gender on one's birth certificate, as has happened in Kansas, Montana, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Tennessee. Now, in the face of these legislative and policy assaults on trans life, I can imagine some of your listeners wondering, okay, we're in a state of emergency. Why should we care what psychoanalysis has to say? Thank you for flagging this for us, but let's stop talking about psychoanalysis. Let's talk about policy. Let's talk about activism. Let's talk about laws. Here's why people should care about what psychoanalysis has to say about transness, has to say about queerness. Because psychoanalytic activists have been busy writing papers that are opposing gender affirmative care for trans youth, or opposing the very existence of transgender children. And there's a group called SEGEM, that stands for the Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine. This is actually an international group. Its members are psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, psychologists, other kinds of therapeutic practitioners. and they are publishing papers that the Southern Poverty Law Center actually considers to be pseudoscience and part of actually a hate campaign against LGBTQ people. But those papers are being cited by policymakers, by legislators who are passing anti-trans legislation. So some psychoanalysts, some psychiatrists are basically, this is a strong word, but helping to launder anti-trans legislation, make it seem scientific. And this is among the many reasons why we can't so easily dismiss what psychoanalysis has to say.
That's Anne Pellegrini talking about their and Avhi Sakotopoulou's book, Gender Without Identity. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Anne's books include Performance Anxieties, Staging Psychoanalysis, Staging Race, and Love the Sin, Sexual Regulation and the Limits of Religious Tolerance, co-authored with Janet Jacobson. Avhi is the author of Sexuality Beyond Consent, Risk, Race, Traumatophilia. Both are NYU faculty members and practicing psychoanalysts. Let's return to more of their talk. Here, Avhi Sakotopoulou talks about
one of the other preoccupations in our book, the question of if these kinds of propositions are not sufficient and they're actually harmful to trans and queer people, what do we have to propose instead? So Anne and I are writing as part of a growing minority of psychoanalysts who have pretty extensive experience working with trans and queer patients. I myself am also working with trans children for over 20 years now and their families. And we belong to this kind of like group of clinicians all over the world who vociferously oppose the suppression of trans life. And we are ourselves members of the queer community. And yet, we're actually not so quick to say that trauma does not have anything to do with how individuals experience their gender, because we believe that trauma may have a share in how somebody comes to experience their gender. And our own work with trans children and adults leads us to some surprising and even counterintuitive observations, that sometimes transness, far from being a symptom of trauma, can emerge from trauma. And to take this even further, we are not even saying that this is specific to transness only. All gender is to some degree shaped by trauma. In other words, gender is the outcome of how trauma forces the psyche to respond, which means that the psyche has to innovate and to invent. If trauma has become the epicenter of corrective attention, where trauma is something that needs to be identified and fixed, because in the transphobic fantasy that Anne was speaking to, trauma is something that, if corrected, can then ostensibly return, I put this in quotes, scare quotes, return somebody to their quote-unquote normal gender. So if trauma has become the epicenter of corrective attention only when it comes to gender expansiveness, it's only because atypical genders are seen as being a priori less than, unwanted, unwelcome, and strange. And we just refuse that framework to say that all gender has something to do with trauma. So we basically wrote Gender Without Identity because we have been feeling both unsatisfied with the current discourse and the binary option of either born this way or warped this way that Anne described. And because we're tired of the blackmail that the born this way argument is based on, kind of like, and that blackmail is that any other accounting of queer or trans existence endangers us, endangers queer people, endangers trans people, because we believe that there's actually a dire need for ideas that don't capitulate to the notion that the only way to counter the pathologizing of queer and gender and sexual complexity is by imagining that they are innate, that we are born with them, and that there's nothing, that environment, relation, trauma has nothing to do with them. It's not humane to regard variant genders and sexualities without the resource of psychic complexity that is so routinely afforded to normative subjects. So we have been urging through our work colleagues to let go of arguing innateness as the LGBTQ party line. Not only have born this way arguments failed to insulate queer people from violence and discrimination, they haven't actually worked. Not only are such arguments ethically short-sighted, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how somebody became queer or trans because there's nothing wrong with being queer or trans. If there's a reason to not discriminate against queer and trans people, it's because it's unethical to discriminate against people, not because of this or that reason. And if from a psychoanalytic perspective, these are also really oversimplified and clinically naive, actually. So much more importantly, to acquiesce to the born this way rhetoric is impoverishing. It impoverishes our conversations about the complexity of queer and trans life. It impoverishes clinical practice, and it also impoverishes, and this is one of our most important and important to us, and I think relevant clinical interventions. It impoverishes the capacity to appreciate that there's a strange kind of psychic agency involved in becoming trans, becoming non-binary, and becoming queer. And, you know, as a queer person myself, in the Venn, saying the phrase becoming trans or becoming queer feels anxiety provoking because we are accustomed to being told that the only legitimate way to be trans or queer is if you were always that way. But we want to stay close to thinking about this as agency and to think of it also as strange because it is not willful in the sense of somebody consciously deciding that they're going to do this or that. Because it does not issue from a centered self, but that, and this kind of like is part of our contribution, that it is autonomous in a psychoanalytic sense, that it always has to do with materials, with experiences, with histories that come to us from outside. They're always allocentric. So rather than this idea that gender is something true at the core of the self that one just has to discover, and if it has been influenced by the outside, that means that it's not your true gender, you're just catching something or are being warped by something. We think that gender, all gender, not just the gender of trans people or non-binary people, all gender is always allocentric. So rather than running the hamster wheel time and again to confront homotransphobia, what we have wanted to do is recalibrate our attention to build a theory and thinking that we need to be able to enable the flourishing of our queer and trans patients in a consulting room. And that involves being able to be more in one's gender or one's queerness without being played about whether one is authentically queer or truly trans. Not because it is true, but because all genders are mythological constructions. All genders are to some degree made up, including and especially cis and binary genders. Even though that is not to refuse or to say that by saying that they're mythological constructions, to say that they don't have material consequences. So our starting point is that there's nothing wrong with being queer or trans. There's no wrong way to become, to be queer or trans. And most importantly, there's no wrong way to become queer or trans. So to do this way, we have had to push back against a stance that is very prominent in our field and actually in all therapeutic fields. And quite popular and uninterrogated in popular culture, which is a stance that we call traumatophobic. And what we mean by that is kind of like we are contesting the idea that if trauma has a share in the development of somebody's gender, that definitionally invalidates their gender, that it makes it inauthentic or false. In other words, we want to resist the traumatophobic logic, which sees anything that is connected to trauma as being cause for suspicion or alarm. And we advocate for thinking traumatophilically, to view trauma not as a way of questioning the plausibility of queer and trans life, but as a way that kind of like helps us articulate its textures. So we are committed to a form of thinking that helps clinicians, but also helps the general public build a tolerance for thinking about how trauma is actually spun into the subject, to think about what subjects do with their trauma, and to stay away from this fantasy that is very prominent these days, that there's a way to kind of like go in and surgically extract trauma from somebody who has suffered it and repair it so that the person can go back to who they were before the trauma and then everything will be fine. I mean, that just doesn't happen. We're interested in how trauma kind of like also becomes part of what constitutes the self, that after you've experienced trauma, trauma does not just stop you, it also participates in shaping you And that's not the same as saying that trauma distorts you or that it bends you out of shape. We're interested in how trauma is spun into the subject, not in the sense of something that is kind of like consciously produced, a self-understanding by a volitional subject, but in a way that it arises as a psychic response by being breached by the other and by the other's otherness, by what others bring to us that is not in our control, and how it's driven by the exigency of the unconscious. So we have wanted to do this theorizing to show that it is possible to look in the rearview developmental mirror and to actually think about how somebody's gender became what it was, what it is, without insinuating that they detoured from a normal gender course and without capsizing into conversion therapy. And it's important to emphasize here that we are not trying to find a way to account for people's gender, but we do want to create theory and give us ways of thinking for people who want to tell stories about their own gender becomings. Because in the consulting room, when people feel safe, they often, trans people, non-binary people, queer people, often become curious about how their experiences kind of like weigh into their lives, into their identities, into the textures of their understanding of themselves. This is exactly what cis and straight people do in therapy all the time. And it's also important to note that we are not trying to prescribe how anybody who's gay or queer or trans understands their own origins. We're not saying that if somebody experiences themselves as having been born their way, they're wrong. To the contrary, we see psychoanalytic ethics as giving individuals, especially individuals from oppressed minorities, the chance to use their names and generate the self-understandings that resonate for them, not that are legislated by the lawmaker or the doctor or the therapist. What we want to do is make room for more ways for psychoanalysts, for clinicians, for our culture to understand that gender and sexuality have a background always, and that having a history does not delegitimize them. So the ethical call that we offer in Gender Without Identity is to provide ranges of understandings and clinical frameworks that treat gender and sexual diversity, not by making room for them or accepting them. We don't want the philanthropy of tolerance. We want a psychoanalysis and a culture that actively wants gay people and wants trans people. We want and deserve spaces that delight and marvel in the pleasures of difference rather than simply accepting that people are different. There's so much possibility and so much richness that comes from the fact that we're all different, and trying to eliminate that and constrict it into kind of like templates or binaries is not a good idea, not only for trans and queer people, it impoverishes everyone.
That's Avi Sakutopoulou and Anne Pellegrini talking about their new book, Gender Without Identity. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, including the spelling of Avi's name. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Avi is a psychoanalyst in private practice in New York City and a member of the faculty at New York University's postdoctoral program on psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. Anne is professor of performance studies and social and cultural analysis at New York University and a practicing psychoanalyst. And now I want to ask you to some questions coming out of that talk and some things also I've been thinking about since reading portions of your book, Gender Without Identity. You're pushing back against the born this way rhetoric. And it's one thing to push back against rhetoric, and it's another thing to kind of have evidence for the argument you're making, that in fact, if I understand correctly, trans and queer people are not born that way, that it's not an innate thing, and that it is a trauma, as you're saying, trauma that shapes, to some degree, all gender, including cisgender. And you referred to the fact that you've had clinical experiences. You've delivered therapy, psychoanalysis to people. Can you share some of the evidence you have for your understanding that the born this way argument is wrong? And can you also talk about how conclusive that evidence can be, since it's anecdotal, since It's based presumably on personal experiences you've had with a finite number of clients. And then maybe some people, right, some fellow psychoanalysts you've talked to who've maybe had similar experiences and come to similar conclusions in relation to the Born This Way argument. How much evidence does one need in order to say with some confidence that Born This Way is wrong?
This is such a great question, because so many of the conversations right now that we're having around transness tend to orbit around this issue of evidence and proof. And before answering your question, which I'll do in a second, I want us to take a minute and pause and wonder what it might be like for trans people to have to be constantly faced with this question of, what proof do we have that you're valid? How do we decide that your existence is not some deviation? And that asking those questions, even though it's necessary, and I'm glad you asked this, because it captures something about how these discussions are proceeding as if they are debates, as if there's something that can be debated on the basis of evidence about trans existence. So before I head into how we have arrived at these conclusions, I want to also put some pressure on how unquestioned the method seems to be, that the way to have this conversation is to be by counting, by accounting, by measuring, by reporting, by having charts. And because what this can miss is the qualitative aspect of the experience of trans people. So I just wanted to say this on the basis of, like, what does it mean to talk about methodology? And with that, kind of like having been marked, you're absolutely right. Our evidence is anecdotal. I wouldn't even call it evidence, because there's no way to extract one's own observation from what one is observing in the consulting room. I think this is true for kind of like even the most seemingly objective scientific methods. But what we have come, I'll speak for myself, even though I assume that Anne will agree with most of what I'll say, but I'll speak for myself. Like, when you're sitting with a patient multiple times a week for many, many years, you're not just hearing the stories that people want others to hear, or how they're guarding themselves for fear that they will be misunderstood. You begin to hear things that even patients hear themselves say for the first time. You begin to hear things that, like, even the person you're working with would have never allowed themselves to consider. But now, as they're understanding more the impact of this experience or that encounter or the other trauma, they're beginning to wonder what their connections might be. So things emerge in real time. And that means that the inquiry is very different than just measuring things that are already there. Things unfold, and you're part of that unfolding. And that makes you into a very different kind of witness and a very different kind of researcher, because you're not just looking to capture data points that are already there. You're present for things that are emerging in real time. And that is a very particular kind of responsibility and a very particular kind of privilege. So when you sit time and again with patients who have, say, transitioned, and after they have secured, for example, their right to have top surgery or to have access to hormones, are allowing themselves to question things, to ask, not to question their gender, sometimes even that too, that should not be off the table, but to question, like, how are the ways that I have had to represent myself to the world in order for the world to believe me? Now that I am in more or less the body that I want, because who is really in a body that they want 100% and all of the time? Like, no, nobody gets that privilege, right? Even cis people. Once people are in this place that feels like they don't have to constantly be protecting their rights, they begin to ask questions that are new, that are curious about kind of like the derivation of their experience, about where things come from, and not just about their gender. And indeed, like, this is not robust evidence in that sense of counting it, measuring it, giving a report of its validity, of its repeatability, of its cross-cultural relevance. But I think that the pressure here should be on why that is the method, because that method is actually not friendly to queer or trans life. These are methods that were made for different kinds of experiences and which are countable and reportable for people whose experience has a home in the world. So it is legitimate to be asking, is that the right method for a minority population?
And I think I'll just add, sort of building on what Avi said, that if we step outside the consulting room and actually listen, well, if we could listen in on conversations that do happen within queer and trans spaces, and for a long time, we know that the rhetoric of born this way has never captured the experience of everyone who could reasonably stand under the letters LGBTQ. There are many LGBTQ people who would say of their experience, of their gender or sexuality, that it has felt like a durable feature of their experience. So much so that born this way, I think as a metaphor, seems to capture it. But there are many other LGBTQ identified people who would not describe their gender, their sexuality, their desire, the way they wish to configure the relationships, the kinds of sex they want to have. They would not describe these experiences as always a feature of their self-understanding. So we need to have space politically, we need to have space in our consulting room for those diverse self-understandings. And born this way is too blunt, it's too reductionist, and to the extent that it doesn't capture the experience, again, of those people whom it's supposedly representing, something is wrong with that rhetoric. It just doesn't work. It's not accurate.
I also want to add one more thing to kind of like, as Anne is talking about what's happening outside the consulting room. Like, I'm thinking of research that was done by Kristen Schild and Chase Joint and was presented in a documentary called Framing Agnes, in which Jules Gill-Peterson made kind of like had a lot of contribution. I know you've talked to Jules recently, where kind of like this conversation began unfolding of if the demand for access to certain kinds of care is a very tight narrative, what are people going to do in order to survive? They're going to start producing that narrative, and people are going to start lying to get from doctors what they need. And lying here is not a method of deception. It's a method of survival. So you end up with this research of like more and more people reporting that they always felt this way, at times even hiring actors to come in as their parents and produce these kinds of histories so that the doctor would be satisfied and give them the letter they needed or the medical treatment they needed. So you begin to see that even these kind of like measurables are not reliable or objective in the way that you think, because people are forced into positions of having to generate these very tight understandings and these very limited understandings in order to be given any validity.
You claim that all gender, including cisgender, is to some degree shaped by trauma. How can, for example, cis femininity come out of trauma?
This is a really important question, and in some ways, this claim surprised us. Because as we were working on the book, we'd been working from the premise that psychoanalysis constantly asks the question of trans and queer people, where did you come from? Basically, what's the explanation for the origins of queerness and transness? And that it somehow took cisness and heterosexuality for granted. And as we were going back over the literature, realizing like, oh, wait a minute, psychoanalysis has actually, from its early days, seen certainly the achievement of normative gender as actually being an achievement. It hasn't taken for granted that someone who is ascribed male or female at birth will just seamlessly pass into the position of masculinity if ascribed male at birth, or into femininity if ascribed female at birth. That gender has been seen as an achievement from the early days of psychoanalysis. Now, this is not a position that has been maintained consistently, but it's there in some early and crucial texts in psychoanalysis, Freud being, sort of actually quite an interesting figure in this regard. So let's put a pin in that for the moment. If we think about what it's like to be someone named female, raised to be a girl who will become a woman, One of the crucial ways in which that gender starts to take shape for such a person is that this girl, who will become a woman, that's the demand, is constantly harried with the threat of sexual violence. She's confronted with misogyny, and this is actually baked into what it means to be a girl, what it means to become a woman. So we could say that the threat of sexual violence and the actual experience of it, these are formative of the very meaning, the very experience of femininity. So it is, in fact, we would say that the trauma of misogyny, the trauma of threatened, if not actual sexual violence, is constitutive of femininity, of cis femininity.
That's the voice of Anne Pellegrini. They and Avi Sakatopoulou, my other guest, are co-authors of the book Gender Without Identity, published by The Unconscious in Translation. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Your work draws in important ways on the writings of Jean Laplanche, the French thinker and psychoanalyst, born 1924, died 2012. Talk about the debt you owe to his ideas, his theorizing, in the context of the specific argument you're making in this book.
This is a really great question, because psychoanalysis has so much bad rap against it. So I'm happy to take this on. This is Avi Sakatopoulou speaking. And to say that we use Jean Laplanche, but also use him as read through queer of color critique and trans of color critique, meaning that we take some of his ideas, we use some of his ideas, but we also put them to the pressure of these other kinds of discourses. So there's two things that Jean Laplanche brings to analytic thinking that have felt very formative and informative to us. The first is the idea that trauma is constitutive, meaning that it is because of trauma that the psyche is forced to respond and to generate all kinds of experiences that come to feel like they're part of the self. And in that sense, trauma, as opposed to many other psychoanalytic models that see trauma as just breaking you or interrupting you, Jean Laplanche's theory gives us the tools that we need to think about how trauma is actually part of who you are. For example, if you are a Black person, the intergenerational trauma of slavery, the trauma of anti-Black racism, does not only harm you, it also inflects your racialization. It inflects how you're Black, how you think about race. It doesn't just produce difficult things, it also texturizes who you are in the world, how you understand social relations. And these are resources that we get from Jean Laplanche. The other thing that we get from him, which is really fascinating, is this deep conviction that gender is one of the ways in which we repress. In other words, try to control, try to manage or tame the unknowability of psychic life. So gender becomes one way to give form to things that are formless in us. And that the way that this form giving happens is through borrowing materials that come to us from the outside, that they're not just about recognizing something true or authentic in the core of the self, but involve the scavenging of social materials from the world, like how people think about gender, the ways in which gender is racialized, the way in which religion actually inflects gender. This is something that we talk a lot about in the clinical case in Gender Without Identity, that these categories are not separable from each other. So he gives us the resources with which to take seriously the idea that gender is not an interior process, but arises always in interaction with the social world. And we actually pick and choose through this queer agency of the unconscious how to put together materials that we didn't choose, conditions that we did not consent to. Like, gender is an imposed system. But it's an imposed system in a way that, you know, everybody has to find their place in the gender spectrum. Most people, even people who are agender, will say, this is my sense of my gender. This is an imposition, but it's an imposition from culture that is not necessarily a problem in the sense that it gives you the opportunity to craft something about which you can feel good, about which can feel pleasurable to you, which can feel to you that it gives you a sense of yourself. It can give you a sense of, like, this is who I am. It gives you a sense of, like, belonging in certain communities. This is one way to think about how that imposition from the outside, how the trauma forces the psyche to invent, as we were saying earlier. But key to LaPlanche's intervention is this idea that psychic life gets put together in a way that is allocentric, meaning that it centers not around the individualized, privatized self, which is what, you know, capitalism and kind of like liberalism, neoliberalism wants us to think, that we're all individual subjects. All we have to do is look into ourselves and determine who we are and then ask others to respect it. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But at the end of the day, it's an individual endeavor. No. LaPlanche gives us the tools with which to think about how everything that happens inside is always in some dialogue with what happens outside, in our relationships, in our cultures, in histories that we did not choose, but nevertheless labor under, like histories of genocide, histories of historical trauma. And in the clinical case in our book, we talk a lot about the braid of antisemitism and gender and how the two come together in the particular child we're working with.
I want to also just underscore something that Avi said, which is that we're drawing on LaPlanche, but we're querying and transing LaPlanche, because we're putting LaPlanche to work through the prism of our deep engagement with work that comes out of queer theory and trans of color critique in particular. And one of the things that LaPlanche helps us think about, but again, with these resources coming from outside psychoanalysis, queer and trans studies, LaPlanche helps us think about how material on the outside becomes available, like cultural material. He uses the language, LaPlanche does, of the mytho-symbolic, but material in culture. It's a resource for self-understanding. For historical reasons, right, we live in a culture that demands we can give an account of ourselves in the language of gender, in the language also of sexuality. So we have to say, what is our true gender? What is our true sexuality? And there are historical reasons for why we're demanded to give a self-accounting in these terms, right? Now, what is the language available for such a self-accounting? That language, we have a binary language of male and female, but that language has come under pressure historically. So now we actually have more terms. There's more language than just a binary language. LaPlanche helps us think about how these cultural shifts in the language available for naming ourselves, describing ourselves, giving an account of ourselves, how those shifts could actually be experienced not just from one generation to the next. So now there are, now it's possible for children, for example, to understand themselves to be trans or understand themselves to be non-binary. Certainly, yes, we see generational transformations. But with LaPlanche, we could also start to understand how within any one individual's lifetime, that person could start to change how they understand themselves. Perhaps at one moment in their lifetime, they understood themselves to be maybe a butch lesbian. And at another point, they start to understand themselves to be non-binary or maybe transmasculine. And these shifts are shifts not necessarily about, oh, I've now discovered my true gender. I used to think I was a butch lesbian. Now I understand myself to be a trans man. That could be how one person comes to understand themselves. But it could also be that these are shifts that are indeed occurring, that are shifts in relationship to new namings that have become possible in the wider culture. And so, and the LaPlanche that we're putting under pressure with queer and trans theory, we're also able to understand not just historical transition, transformation from one generation to the next, but we're able to develop, I think, a richer, more complex language for transition within any one individual lifetime. This is especially important in the face of the way that detransition narratives are being weaponized against trans people. With LaPlanche, we would say that all gender is about transition, that maybe we could say strongly, it's transition all the way down. And this is, I think, really important because we could then say, and we're happy to talk about detransition more, that instead of speaking in terms of detransition, someone who understood themselves to be trans and then decides, oh, I'm not trans, really, I'm cis. Instead of this narrative detransition, we would see this as a retransition. All gender for everybody involves transition. Again, transition all the way down. There might be gradations in terms of that transition. For some people, a transition will not involve a new naming, the shift from cis to non-binary, or from non-binary to trans, or from trans to cis. The transition might be of a smaller gradation, where it's a different understanding of how they're doing their femininity, not a transition from femininity to anything else. But again, we're saying transition all the way down. And LaPlanche helps us think about this.
So let's say someone's looking for a therapist for a loved one and doesn't want somebody who interprets trauma in a certain way, right? Who sees trauma as warping somebody who has non-normative gender, but rather sees trauma as generative, as something that inevitably shapes, and not necessarily in a negative way, shapes the development of one's gender. How could one go about finding the right person with the right and most generous attitude?
What a key question to ask, because many people are wondering about that, especially parents who are trying to think about who to seek help for their children. And I would say a couple of different things. Some things tend to go together, like the attitude about trauma that you just described that doesn't treat it as having necessarily damaged somebody, but also as being possibly a generative resource and even having something to do with gender, usually goes together with an attitude of not treating transness as a problem to begin with and not understanding it as a de facto deviation that needs to be fixed. The critical question is, how do you find clinicians? How can you tell from interviewing clinicians or looking into somebody's credentials that somebody thinks this way? Because of course, no clinician, even if they think that, is going to say that to you in this way, because many of them don't even understand themselves to be doing something that is transphobic. Charles Socarides, who is like the most famous psychoanalyst, who penned some of the most homophobic practices for gay patients, kind of like died protesting being called homophobic, when in fact he was very homophobic. So somebody's self-description is not going to be enough. What you will notice is that colleagues who are trying to look for ways to fix transness, first of all, will never talk about trans children, or will say that they will talk about gender dysphoria. They will talk about doctors accelerating treatments that we have no proof for, when in fact many of the interventions we have been around for a very long time, just not, they have been researched, they're not specifically for gender issues, but they've been around, so we know their biological impacts. You will hear them talk about being concerned about the child's reproductive potential, and the question of like whether their child can have children or not. This is not an irrelevant consideration. I'm not saying that this doesn't matter. But clinicians who can operate in ways that are very proximate to conversion practices foreground that. And they also speak about changes in the body as amputations. They foreground regret. Again, these are not things to not think about. Regret is a human condition. People regret all kinds of things in their lives. And these are conversations to have with thoughtful clinicians. It's the disproportionate weighing of these factors. They don't talk about trans joy. They don't talk about the fact that trans people can have very, very fulfilling lives. And there are, as Anne mentioned earlier, clinicians who are affiliated with the hate group SEGAM and GenSpect. Definitely doing your research on that helps. But then there are other organizations like GIRA and Therapy First who include many of the same clinicians and who keep changing their names, because as the literature on them possibly engaging in heirs to conversion practices is accumulating, they're just flitting around creating new organizations and new names so that they try to shed the weight of this these problems. Many of them use the term exploratory to speak not about the way in which all therapy is exploratory, but actually to smuggle in the idea that gender needs to be explored over such a long amount of time and with such watchful waiting attitude that kids will go into puberty without having a chance to go on blockers, where effects by biological puberty will be irreversible on their bodies. So you have to be cautious about the word exploratory. Again, all therapy involves exploration, but some of these treatments foreground that as a way of preparing parents for having to wait a very long time to make any decisions about their children, even when things are clearer.
Avi Sakutopoulou and Anne Pellegrini talking about their new book, Gender Without Identity. We have a link to that book and to websites, more information about Avi and Anne on our website, againstthegrain.org. They are practicing psychoanalysts, and they both teach at New York University, Avi in the postdoctoral program on psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, and is professor of performance studies and social and cultural analysis at NYU. And Avi, thanks very much for writing this book and for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
It was really a pleasure to be in conversation with you. Thank you so much for the seriousness of your engagement.
And The Unconscious in Translation, publisher of Gender Without Identity, is offering Against the Grain listeners a 25% discount off the price of the book, and in fact, off the price of any of their books, if you order from their website by July 15th. Click on the link to the book we've provided on againstthegrain.org, or go to uitbooks.com and use the discount code KPFA at checkout. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.